Live and in color from the NBC News Radio Broadcasting Studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful Southern California, and in parallel from the Turfs Up Radio Studio in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Thanks for tuning in to the Water Zone Show this evening.
And a pleasant afternoon and good afternoon to everybody. This is Rob Starr, your host of the show. Our other, my distinguished other co-host, Chris Davies, was actually in eastern Utah on vacation, and I guess they had a snowstorm, and they canceled all the planned activities that he had, so he's on his way back. But that's okay. We wish him a nice, safe drive back, and was hoping everything was fine for his trip, but we'll learn about it more next week. But we're going to bring in one of our favorite people, Ms. Chris Austin, who's the purveyor of Maven's Notebook, and she is the most important person and most knowledgeable person on water and what's happening in the state of California and also around the world as well. So, Chris, welcome to the show again.
Hey, welcome, everybody. How you doing?
We're doing fine, and I hope you're safe from the fires out there in California.
Oh, yeah, we're not doing too bad down here in Southern California. Our air quality is pretty darn bad, but it's not nearly what they're having to deal with up in Northern California, so we have listeners up there. I hope you guys are all safe. It's the pictures coming out of the Bay Area are just like apocalyptic. There's no other word for it. I mean, so dark during the day yesterday that the street lights did not turn off. So, you know.
Wow. Yeah, I was watching Governor Newsom earlier today, and I guess because of the fires in the neighboring states as well, you know, they usually share help, you know, firefighters and stuff. But right now it's very, very difficult to get extra bodies to help them put out. And then I was watching a gentleman this afternoon. I forget his first name. His last name is Schellenberger, and he's an environmentalist. And he was saying that, you know, people are blaming the drought and other things on these fires. And he, and his comment and take on it, he's the author of a book called Apocalypse Never. And he was saying today that the reason that there's fires is not necessarily because of the drought or anything else. It's because they don't manage the forest well enough. They don't burn off what needs to be burnt off, and all this extra wood fuel, you know, is available. And that's kind of the reason why we're seeing more fires. That's the majority of the reason versus, you know, a drought situation. Do you think about that?
No, absolutely, and that's correct. And I, you know, I would like to point out that that's not the environmentalist's fault. That's not the Democrats' fault. That the policy of suppressing fires actually dates back to around the early 1900s when they had some kind of major fire in the Midwest that blew through numerous states and killed all kinds of people. And so after that happened, they said, you know what, we're going to have a policy of suppressing fires. And so they went about suppressing all fires. You know, the goal was to just kill it off. But the problem is that, or, you know, the thing is that our Sierra Nevada forest, the pine forest, and a lot of other forests, you know, fire is kind of part of the natural ecosystem, and fires would naturally kind of go through. And the indigenous people, the Indians, the Native Americans who were here before us, understood the value of fire and the value of burning off the understory. But, you know, when we came out and developed the West, you know, the loss of life was just not tolerable, so the idea was, you know, suppress the fires. And so, you know, there's a whole push to get back to prescribed burning and other practices that kind of help burn out the understory, but there are, you know, literally millions of acres that are really completely overgrown. And it's going to take a lot. But again, you know, this is not a Democrat thing or an environmentalist thing. This is a policy that was enacted by who knows whoever it was that was in power in the early 1900s because they were responding to the loss of life.
Right.
You know, and unfortunately, it's turned into something much worse. And, you know, cleaning out the forest and kind of getting rid of this is a very expensive and labor-intensive process, but they are making steps forward, both in the state's forest and in the federal forest. And actually, I do believe that federal forested lands make up the majority of the forest here in California.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, so I just want to say, you know, when certain people might point at California, most of those areas, most of our forested acres are under federal control. So
right.
There you go.
Well, I know I lived in Orange County, you know, in the city of Anaheim Hills. There used to be notices from the fire department that if you are by a hill or specific area, that you have to burn like 50 feet or 100 feet down. And do that every year, keep it maintained and such. And that's really a great idea because, as you said, all this underbrush and stuff can be torched and by lightning or whatever. Somebody throws a cigarette or who knows what. It's the devastating fires that happen. I mean, when I lived there in Orange County, I was evacuated twice, you know, for fires that started. They were huge fires. You know, luckily, nobody got killed. I mean, there were homes lost, lots of homes lost, but nobody got killed over it. But it's dangerous. That really needs to happen. But anyway, you know, I was reading your information that you put out every single day in the notebook, and it's actually the first thing I do when I turn my computer because it pops up automatically that it's already arrived, which I really like. And you talked about, which I think our listeners might be interested, because there's a lot of people when I go out and talk to conferences or water agencies and things, they understand it, but the public has all these questions about you know, Department of Water Resources and all of this other stuff. So to me, you know, there's like four water major entities in California, and I thought maybe that would be a good way to start this off to inform our listeners what are they and what do they do and how do they work together? Do they work separately, and so forth and so on?
Yeah, and it's interesting. There's a media outlet that's been comparing these water entities or different entities. They put out a series of articles, and this last one is the latest one. And they did a pretty good job of picking out the four water entities. Other of their you know, earlier articles where they picked out different things, I could have debated that there were others that should have made that list. But this one is pretty good. Yeah, there's a lot of different entities in California that regulate water. And I mean, it's actually numbers in the thousands when you get down to all the different local districts. And you know, we love government so much here in California, we just create all these, you know, numerous entities. But there are about four at the top. I would say kind of three, but, you know, we'll say four. And they kind of rank them here in different ways. I would say probably the one that's most impactful to people is the State Water Resources Control Board, because they're the regulatory agency in California, and they are responsible for implementing the Clean Water Act, the federal legislation that was enacted in the 1970s, and also the state's version of that, which is called the Port of Cologne Act, which is actually takes the federal regulations and it's a bit stricter than them. And the Port of Cologne Act created the State Water Resources Control Board and the nine regional boards. And they have to implement all the regulations primarily with surface water. So if you have a discharge, you're an industrial facility or you're a wastewater treatment plant, and you are discharging water to a river or a stream or some instance where it's going to flow into another water body, you have to get a permit, and you would get a permit from the state, from your regional water board. And the state water board deals with other things on a larger scale. They deal with the Delta too, because the Delta has been deemed so important that it's a state level thing, not a regional thing. But most people, if you are working in your local area and you need to discharge to a waterway, or even a discharge to land, if you're going to pool some type of discharge from your facility in a pooling facility to dry it, there are standards that you must take and permits you must get so that you don't contaminate groundwater. So that, you know, that's the biggest one in terms of what affects people, you know, in their day-to-day life. Another one is the Department of Water Resources. And the Department of Water Resources is sort of like the statewide level for responding to all sorts of things like floods and droughts. And they also run the State Water Project, which is which brings a lot of water down to Southern California. And because they have the State Water Project and they impact the Delta ecosystem, they also have a strong science program, and they restore habitats and for endangered species. But in general, if you're a regular person, you're not really going to deal with the Department of Water Resources. And the third big one, I think, is the California Water Commission. And they sort of oversee, to a certain extent, the Department of Water Resources and the State Water Project. They are the entity that when California voted in Prop 1 back, I don't know, I can't remember, 2013, 2014, I can't remember when it was, but that had funds for water storage projects, meaning dams or groundwater storage projects, and they were the entity, the government entity that was in charge of dispersing those funds. And so they're still working on, you know, managing those projects and seeing that they come to fruition. But that's sort of their big thing. And they also oversee the State Water Project, and they're sort of the place where if you are a stakeholder in the Delta or, you know, in some way in largely invested in this, in the water infrastructure, you would go to the California Water Commission and you could speak to them about your problem. So that's kind of what they do. The fourth one is the California Water Quality Monitoring Council, which they highlighted, which is interesting. This is just an effort to better coordinate multiple sources that are monitoring water quality in various ways throughout the state. And there are various different programs that do this, and they have they passed a law several years ago that said that they wanted to be better coordinated on this. And one of the outcomes of this is there is a series of portals available to State Water Board at mywaterquality.com, where you can actually check on the status of different types of water that's in your area. Like you want to know, you know, can I go swimming in that river? Or, you know, what's the quality at the beach? Or how is this estuary doing? They have all these various different portals that they have created where you can go in and it actually interprets the data for you so you can understand what's going on if you want to dig into it. So, you know, it's a very productive program, and they've got a lot of products out. One of the biggest things that they have just implemented is a portal for harmful algal blooms, which is the big issue. So if you wanted to go to a lake, you could, or, you know, a particular reservoir or whatever, you can check and make sure that they're not having problems with toxic algal blooms. So it's a very productive program. that they have. I wouldn't put it in the same category as the other three, but I would definitely say it's a very productive program and an appropriate use of our taxpayer dollars. They have a lot of products on, you know, mywaterquality.com that are really intended for the stakeholders and the regular people in the community to use. So,
So on an org chart, they go all the way up to the governor's office, I would assume. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, the governor has the, you know, he's the head chief of the whole state operation. So, you know, they're all connected to the big guy in some way.
So he's the chairman of the board. And so I've noticed in some cases over the years that one agency argues or is in total disarray or a disagreement with one of the other ones. And that happens on occasion. Is that when they do the head changes or they try to work out the issues?
Well, you know, I think that actually the agencies are seeming to be working together a lot better than they used to be. You know, there are stories of how, like, they used to attack each other. I mean, and it was pretty brutal, and they had lawyers and scientists, and I mean, I think the animosity, I'm talking back, you know, 2007, 2008, the animosity between the Department of Water Resources and the Department of Fish and Wildlife was, you know, pretty bad. I think it was, I'm not entirely sure, you know, that I'm correct, but I kind of remember Lester Snow, back, who was the director of Department of Water Resources, just stepped down, and he was like, you know, this is crazy. To deal with this, you know, because the vitriol between those two departments was extreme. But I think that there's been a big emphasis in collaboration among the government agencies, the state, especially the state agencies and the local agencies, in trying to get things done, that they've kind of come to understand that if you kind of get everybody in the room and you work together, you can come up with a solution that isn't going to end up in the courts and be litigated and not implemented for, you know, years and years or a decade or however. You can, you know, if the goal is to come to a solution, then the best thing you can do is collaborate.
Yeah.
If your goal is to block, then you argue, you litigate, you do all these other things, you know.
Yeah. I think over the years there's been several people I could commend who've done a good job, and presently I think Wade Crowfoot is doing a great job. He's known him for a long time, and he's a pretty straight shooter, pretty smart man, and he brings a lot of cohesiveness to all the different things. And speaking of cohesiveness, I also learned that a lot of Western states are blasting Utah's plans, so Utah wants to tap some Colorado River water.
Well, Utah, you know, when they divvied up the Colorado River back in the 1920s, Utah got a slice of the Colorado River, but I don't believe they have any infrastructure, or if they do, it's not enough to take what they were given at that time. Now, we're talking 100 years ago. Now, they've had this plan to build a pipeline from Lake Powell that would go to St. George, Utah. And this plan has been in the works for a long time. But, you know, there's real questions as to whether there's any water left. I mean, we've come to understand that when they divided up the water in the 1920s, they weren't particularly smart about it. They didn't assign people a percentage of what the flow in the river was that year. They assigned actual amounts of water. Mm. So when the river started flowing less, you know, there wasn't a way to reduce everybody's use. It just all reverted to the priority systems and these amounts. So But Utah wants to build this pipeline, and they've been talking about it for a while, and the Bureau of Reclamation has gone forward, and they have an environmental impact report out right now, and they're collecting comments. But the rest of the western states, they've come together. They have figured out a plan to manage the river and how they're going to cut back in times of drought. They have really worked on all of this, and now here comes Utah wanting to stick a new straw into it and shake up all of those negotiations one more time. So there's got to be real questions if you live in St. George, Utah, that you're going to be paying for a project that may not be able to deliver water if, you know, the big news is that the Colorado River is drying up. There's not as much flow. They're trying to manage it all. So, you know, if you want to come in there with your straw, it's just going to make a mess of things. So,
Absolutely. Well, Chris, we appreciate you being on the show all the time. And in a couple of weeks, we'll make a special announcement that I have to tell you about, but I can't tell you now. I have to hold this locked over. Got them pulled. Yeah, but we do appreciate it. And for our listeners, please go to amazingnotebook.com and get all this information about water every single morning. You can become a subscriber. You can become a sponsor. But it is the best place to get news up to date. I don't know how you do it. But you cover so much all over the place, and you're amazing. I guess you got a great big staff under you that takes care of it. So we appreciate it.
All right. Good evening, everyone.
Good night. We'll talk to you next week. We're going to take a little break from our sponsors, and we'll be back with our next guest.
KCAA Loma Linda, 1050 AM, K292 FQ Riverside, and K293 CF Moreno Valley.
Time to take a water break and talk some water. Irrigation. Such a refreshing topic. As more and more markets face water restrictions, your customers may be hungry, or should I say thirsty, for water-saving products. For new installations, add options like drip irrigation, controllers that respond to weather data, pressure-regulating heads, or heads with check valves. They all provide easy ways to differentiate your bids and win more jobs. Or for an extra stream of revenue, offer existing customers upgrades like high-efficiency nozzles, rotary nozzles, or Wi-Fi-based controllers. Because when you help your customers save water, you make a world of difference for the earth and your bottom line at the same time. We'll drink to that.
If you knew there was a pipe cement that works better than the one you're currently using, is better for you and the environment, and costs the same or less, would you buy it? Well, no-brainer, right? Weldon, the trusted leader in solvent cements for over 60 years, is pleased to introduce a new line of solvent cements that does all that. Introducing the Eco Series line of solvent cements for PVC piping systems. Not only does it work great and set fast, it also has 30% lower solvent emissions and less smelly fumes, a better workplace environment when you're installing pipes. But don't just take our word for it. EcoSeries products are the only solvent cements that are Green Seal certified for environmental innovation for effective performance, improved working conditions, and for use with potable water. Now available in a medium-bodied fast-setting blue formula, 905 Eco, and a regular-bodied fast-setting clear formula, 900 Eco. Pick up a can today from your local distributor and see, smell, and feel the difference, just like Joe Sweat, president of Sunrise Irrigation, did. He said, after using Weldon's 905 Eco, we immediately noticed the application was smooth and there was noticeably less odor than other blue solvent cements on the market. The guys love it. To learn more about Eco solvent cements from Weldon, visit the website at www.weldon.com or call the technical service hotline at 877-477-8327. That's 877-477-8327.
Hi, we're welcome back to the second half of the Water Zone Show. I appreciate everybody listening tonight. And since I'm broadcasting from Arizona tonight, I thought it might be a nice trend to talk to somebody who works in the area of Arizona in the water industry. So we have a nice gentleman on our show. His name is Jim Krupp, and he's the president of AquaTrek. And Jim, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob. I appreciate that.
Good. So one of the things for our listeners here, and you know, since we're in a new state tonight, I thought it might be interesting to kind of go back with you and talk about how did you get into this business, into the water industry? What made you do it?
It was an epiphany. I was a landscape designer and contractor in the Valley of Arizona, and I did this custom home, and the guy called me and said, listen, my water bill is about, well, it was about $900 a month. He was the highest residential user of water in the city of Goodyear, Arizona. And so when I designed it and installed it, I never gave any thought to how much water it would take. I went out to his home, and I looked, of course, at his controller, and the landscape maintenance company that was maintaining his property had it. They didn't know how to set it, so they had it coming on all three programs all day. So I got into it. I started doing that. And then I noticed that he had the ability to get flood irrigation water. So I proposed taking the flood irrigation water, building a basin for it, and then pumping it through the irrigation system to his large residential property. So we went ahead and we did that. And I can remember it was in July of 2007. And while I was out there doing that work, that's when I had the epiphany, and that was that my future was water.
Yeah. And, you know, coming from the design side, you know, I'm sure you came out with some beautiful flora and horticulture things, and obviously the landscaper wanted to keep it nice and fresh and blooming, so he kept adding water to it. But,
yep.
You know, again, people don't think about the cost of water and what it's going to cost. I mean, most landscape contractors only care about their customers seeing nice curb appeal, and that everything is blooming and everything is green, and that's the situation. Now, you're pretty rare in the United States as far as being a certified water manager. I think you're one of 95 in the country. Is that correct?
Yes, that is. So when I got this epiphany, I went home. And I walked in the door and I said to my wife, I just had an epiphany. And she goes, now what? And I go, I think my future is water. So immediately I started looking up where I could go to school to learn about water, water conservation, irrigation water. And, of course, you know, I had taken some Irrigation Association classes, some of the classes that were offered by the Arizona Department of Water Resources. And I began my education moving in that direction to become an expert in irrigation water. And so in Arizona, I'm just one of a few that have that designation.
Oh, that's good. Now, from there, you started AquaTrek.
Yeah, AquaTrek. So I went from a landscape designer contractor to being really a consultant. What happened, Rob, was when I first came up with the idea and I got all this training and I got a very good understanding of how much water landscapes actually require. Once I understood how much water turf requires, trees, and different species, and how much water, I was able to put together a water budget based on the landscaping. So I could look at a landscaping and I could tell you, depending on how many area square feet of turf or acres of turf, plant pallet that was there, I could give you in pretty good terms how much water that landscape needed. So my first focus was how do you budget for water? And once I was able to come up with a budget of what a landscape actually needs, then I could look at what was actually being given to it. And I knew where, you know, I kind of set the bar on where I should be. And then I would look at how much it was getting, and then the goal was to get it down to, you know, where it should be. So the focus has always been on, in the beginning, has always been on creating a budget, whether I'm doing a university or a golf course or a small HOA or a resident's home, the first thing I do is come up with a budget for how much water is needed.
Right. And do you go through a site audit with them initially as well?
Yeah.
See if
so
they have broken pipes or you know, clogged nozzles and all of those things, or the controller's not even set up correctly.
Yeah, well, what we do in when we generally when someone hires us, initially we go in and we do a very comprehensive audit. I'm not talking about catch can tests, even though catch can tests are part of the audit. Our audit is very comprehensive, and it begins with formulating the budget. So we use GIS measurements to actually measure the amount of turf, and then we measure the amount of non-turf areas, and we take a look at the density of the non-turf area and what the plant pallet is. So when we do an audit, we first come up with a budget, a water budget for the property. Then the audit also covers, you know, checking everything you just said. We check the water meters. We check the size of the water meters. We find a lot of times water meters are oversized for landscaping, and they can be downsized and save our client a lot of money. On one property, we saved our client over $6,000 a month by just downsizing some of their water meters. And then we do mapping in the audit. We map all the irrigation stations. So we do a comprehensive from the control, actually from the water meter to the backflow to the controller, all the way out to the sprinkler head, and it's we almost write the Bible on the irrigation system for the property. But by doing so, we can tell our clients exactly where improvements need to be made, what improvements need to be made, and what the rate of return on investment they're going to have by making those improvements.
Yeah. Now, a lot of people think, you know, with all these fancy technologies, you know, have EP controllers and, you know, pressure regulated this and that and so forth, that they're going to save tons of money in the summertime. But actually, they really save more in the wintertime and the cold days. But what have you seen as you're, you know, since you have, you do golf courses, HOAs, universities, the corporate campuses and such, what do you see as the most frequent problem that you run into, aside from obviously they're using a lot of water, but What do you see as the cause of those things?
Well, let's take the programming and set that to the side for a minute, because there's all, you know, programming an irrigation system, unless you've been trained and you know how to program and you know how to run a budget based on a program, that's something that a lot of people, I don't want to go down in that area right now. I think the biggest thing that your listeners can take from our conversation is the efficiency of the system, and improving the efficiency would be where I would start. And that all happens by doing inspections of the irrigation system. So if you want something to run efficient, you have to inspect it. We have a saying, systems don't do what you expect, they do what you inspect. So we train irrigation technicians. We of course, work with large landscape companies. We work with in-house maintenance companies, and we do constant training, free training, for landscape irrigation technicians, where we show them how to go out, how to do an inspection, how to check a controller, how to troubleshoot a controller, how to do ohms readings on the valve, how to go out, make adjustments, so that if we can raise the efficiency of the irrigation system, we can dial down the programming. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in a lot of these companies or businesses that you go into, do they contact you because they're getting walloped in the price of water and what they're paying for it? Or that they just want to start being smarter and get more into the sustainability range? Or is it a mixture of both nowadays?
I wish it was the sustainability, but it's the dollar. So normally what happens is they're paying $1 million a year plus in water usage for irrigation. And, you know, so we usually get called in because there's real concerns that the water cost, in some cases the water cost, have exceeded the maintenance cost of the property. So when they call us on the phone, the first thing they call us in for is to say, hey, our water cost on a property in Arizona, the annual water cost was $1.2 million. The board of directors that ran that property knew that that water cost was high, but so they put together a water committee. And when the water committee got together, I mean, they thought, well, should we take out the turf? What should we do? They didn't know where to go. So what one of the committee members did was started to do a search to find somebody who was a water consultant who could come in and help them. And that's how they found me. So when I went in there and they showed me what the amount of water they were using, the first thing I did was do a budget for the property. And I said to them, you're using, 150 million gallons a year. You should be using 90. Yeah. So what happened was the water committee decided, okay, we need to step back and have someone do a comprehensive audit on our system and tell us what's going on. And the landscaper that was maintaining the property really wasn't doing anything wrong. They were just trying to keep together a 22-year-old system with duct tape and wire, Rob. And so the system, I mean, honestly, when it rained, I mean, they had 100 and some controllers out there. It would take them all day to run around and try to turn them off because they didn't work from the master computer, from the central computer. So what we find a lot of times is we have very outdated systems using software that's 30 years old. And so the first thing we do is we go in and we look at how much water should they be using. And then we propose doing an audit. And usually what happens is we take over management of the water while we're doing the audit. And by doing so while we're on site, we're able to save enough money to pay for the audit that's ongoing right there.
That makes total sense.
Yeah, so what we have found is just like if we go into properties, on another property in Arizona, a large property in Scottsdale, they were getting ready to upgrade their system to a new system. And in fact, we were asked to come in and do the technical services and install the new equipment. Unfortunately, the new equipment was still 30-year-old technology. And we just basically said to them, sorry, we can't do this because there's so many better technologies out there right now that we believe that by going in this direction, you're going in the wrong direction. It's going to cost you $1 million to do what you're doing. And if you listen to us, it'll only cost you about a quarter of that. And so we were able to save them $740,000, not on water, Rob, just on the installation of a new system rather than doing what they were planning to do.
Yeah, people have to understand all of that. I mean, I've seen contractors come in and, when they write their maintenance contracts out, and most of the HOA people that I've known in the industry, they manage the HOAs, but they're not irrigation or landscaping specialists. And I'm not saying all companies do this, but some companies can come in and say, hey, we'll repair X amount of valves for you as part of the contract. But then sometimes they come in and say, well, your whole valve is bad. And really, it's only a $3, little diaphragm that goes in there. Sometimes right. That could be the problem. So it's scary for a lot of people. Now, around the country, I know you're familiar with this and such. There's lots of water agencies that provide rebates for using smart irrigation products and things. Now, I don't know, since I'm new to the area here, is it throughout Arizona or only selected areas are into that right now?
Well, the EPA Water Sense program that provided rebates was not funded by the federal government. I was out there this year with the Irrigation Association speaking to Congress, trying to get them to fund the EPA rebate program that would pay for that. So in Arizona, you only have certain cities who are funding the rebates themselves. For instance, the city of Scottsdale provides a $400 rebate for an HOA smart controller, or $250 for a residential smart controller.
And that's not the, that's not a lot of money. I mean, I know in California, Metropolitan Water offers like $50 a station or each channel for the thing. So if you have a 24-station controller, it's 24 times $50 each. So $400, it helps. But, you know, I agree with you. I think they need to put some more dollars into the program. And I was just going to say, I don't mean to divest it from the conversation, but I think farming industry should be able to get rebates for smart controllers and smart irrigation products as well. It's, they use a lot of water, and we need it. Otherwise, we don't get food. So
yeah, you're right. Unfortunately for farmers, you know, farming is a very budget-minded industry, so that in the agriculture business, you know, $5,000 is a lot of money. I mean, it's very difficult for these farmers to invest in technologies that can really benefit their farms. And the state Department of Water Resources should be providing incentives for farms to do this, or even for golf courses, for anybody that uses water. But what they do is they say to the cities, the municipalities, we're going to give you a credit because each municipality has to file a report with the city, with the state water department on how they're managing the water and what conservation plan. And if they have rebate programs in, you know, they get points for that. So a lot of times cities are doing this because it provides them points in their compliance with the state law regarding conservation. That's been the only thing that's been going on is certain cities have been doing it. City of Mesa does it. Some other cities do it. But for farming, and in my opinion, farming is should receive the biggest incentive because certainly farming uses a lot more water than landscaping does in Arizona.
Do you see a future of non-potable water for new homes where they'll pipe both drinking regular water and non-potable water for irrigation and other things? You see, I know a lot of cities in California are going that way. Do you see that as maybe starting to be or is going to be a trend here in Arizona?
Well, it should have been a long time ago. When in Florida, and I'm familiar with Florida, I went out there and did some consulting out there. Some of the cities in Florida, when you build a home, you get your potable water, and then you get effluent water for your landscaping, and then you get your sewer. So you pay an impact fee for a home in Florida to build it in many of these cities. It includes effluent water for your landscaping. So they're much further ahead of the curve than Arizona or other states are. But in Arizona, it would be very difficult now to try to pipe effluent water into every residential neighborhood.
Oh, you can't. You'd be tearing up the streets and everything else. It's impractical. It has to be for new developments. And
yes.
If there's a clear path, and if there has to be a clear path to do the piping to it. Otherwise, it won't be worthwhile in dollars.
I think the effluent water and the better usage of the effluent water, because it's so cost prohibitive to try to pipe it to be used for landscaping, I think the better usage of it, along with the surface water that we receive here in Arizona, is to recharge the aquifers. When we had a higher allotment of water coming in every year through CAP, the Central Arizona Project, we had, a lot of surface water being used for recharge. Now that the Arizona has had to cut down on its water that it receives from the Colorado River, that recharge water hasn't been going into the storage areas to refill the aquifers. I feel the federal government needs to step in, and they need to step in on the 12 states that are really using a lot of aquifer water in the western states. And they need to come in and they need to do a complete basin sweep of the entire 12 states and and we need to know exactly how much water we have there and what, how many years of supply of water we have. Then what we need to do is we need to say, okay, this surface water that we have, let the federal government come in and dig these very expensive recharge wells, and let's start allocating the surface waters, not just from Lake Mead, but from Lake Pleasant and the lakes around here, and using some of that surface water to recharge the aquifers. My concern is, as we lose surface water, we're tapping into, both for farming and for residential, we're tapping into the aquifers more and more. And the sad thing is that the aquifers is not, that's not renewable water. That's not a renewable source. And I think that the state now, this year, is having to mandate a reduction of groundwater, and they're doing it because of the basin sweeps they did this year and last year. Because the state has to assure the federal government that we have a 100-year supply of water before the state can approve another development to go up, new homes to be built, new businesses to be built. So there has to be water available for that. I know this personally because my mother was the former director of HUD in Arizona, and she had to approve every planned unit development. It was because of her and her demand to know that there was enough water to supply these homes that they wanted to build. And this goes back to the 80s, that the state passed the law that set up the Arizona Department of Water Resources. Because she said to them, unless you can prove, I will not allow another building to go up in Arizona. And so state had to pass a law and put together a regulation regarding surface water and provide documentation to my mother and the Department of HUD showing that they had enough water to sustain the growth of what was going to happen to Phoenix.
Yeah. You have a smart mom.
No, I'm telling you, the real estate people hated her, the developers hated her, but it was because of her that the Arizona Department of Water Resources and the legislation took place in the legislature in Arizona to regulate the usage of water and to make sure that we had enough water before we continue building out here. As you know, Arizona, it's grown by leaps and bounds. I mean, from 1979, when I first got here, till now, you can't recognize the place, Rob.
No. I just read that 500 people come here a day to transition here. It's coming in every single day from other states, so it's just booming. But putting your design hat on, back on, okay, for a moment. So, you know, 20 years ago, they threw all kinds of, I'm not saying you or anybody else, I mean, but people put all kinds of stuff in their properties. Today, are people who design more in tune to what needs to be put in or what should be put in to make it more possible to reduce water usage and things? And are a lot of the cities and water agencies helping to write legislation to make those things happen, like where to put the spray heads? Should they be, you know, right at the edge of the property by the cement and the grass, or should they be 12 inches in or 18 inches in? I mean, do those things exist and have changed dramatically in the last, say, 15, 20 years?
It's changed dramatically on the commercial side because of, you know, you have the LED program where you're trying to get a standard for landscaping and for the building. And so they're using smart controllers and precision nozzles and all of that. But in the backyards of people's homes, you're still seeing, they're still growing papayas and everything else in the backyard. In the front yards, like in the city of Scottsdale, you're not allowed to have turf in your front yard in the city of Scottsdale anymore. If you already have it, you can keep it, but no new homes can have turf grass or even a fountain in the front yard in the city of Scottsdale. So the city has dialed it in, city of Scottsdale, and I applaud them for this, to try to, you know, legislate in the city the usage of irrigation water. The reason why was the city of Scottsdale, a home in the average home in the city of Scottsdale used more water than any home in the state of Arizona. In fact, they use, you live in the Verado Buckeye area, and the city of Scottsdale over there, they use three times the amount of an average home in your area.
Wow.
So that's why the city passed legislation that said, okay, city council got together and said, okay, here's the way it's going to be. No turf in the front yard, and we're going to put together a plant pallet, and this is what we're going to do, and everybody's going to have desert native plants in their front yard, bar none. And it has helped. Let me tell you how much it's helped. The city of Scottsdale has grown exponentially over the last 10 years, but their water usage has gone down.
Well, that's impressive.
Now, let me tell you something else. I don't know if you remember, but there were a long time ago, there was the Energy Act was passed, and that's when we started getting low-flush toilets. Do you remember that?
Yep.
And all the appliances in your home were low-water use appliances, and all of that took place. When that happened, because the faucets were changed and the toilets were changed, even though the population in the United States grew, the actual water usage went down. The only way that Arizona could grow to where it's grown to today was because of that legislation, because now all the toilets and all the sinks and all the appliances in your house, you know, are set up to use very little water. Had they not done that, the federal government would not have allowed the amount of growth that we've seen in Arizona.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I can speak in California's size. You know, we have almost 90% of the rainwater that falls in Southern California goes to the ocean.
Yeah.
We need places to store it and such as that. I think that's important. So just for the record here and just for our listeners, if people want to get a hold of you, how can they contact you for your services or your advice or training or any of that?
Well, for anybody, the best thing to do is to call us. The number is 623-594-8689.
Do you have a website?
Yeah.
Go to take a look?
Yep, it is Aqua, AQUA, Track, TRAC, System.com.
Great. And, you know, I appreciate, I love talking with you about what's happening here in Arizona. And for our listeners who in Arizona, I think it's an important factor. I wish there were more people like you who are taking this very seriously. I know there's lots of people around, but I've met you before, and I'm confident that what you do is excellent. And you're going to help a lot of places, golf courses, HOAs, campuses, and even private homes. So my hat's off to you, and I hope we have more people. I'm glad you had an epiphany that day. And I hope your wife is happy you had the epiphany that day. So,
okay.
All right. Thanks. Well, we're up against our NBC News Hour, and we do appreciate you on the show. We'd like to have you back in the future. Come on, maybe talk about the projects that you're working on, how they're coming out, and you know what you're seeing in the industry, and so forth. So, again, Jim, thank you very, very much for coming on the show tonight.
You're welcome, Rob. Take care.
All right. And everybody, we'll be back next week. Chris Davies will be back from Utah. And one thing that we're supposed to say every single week is keep your planet blue. Good night, everybody. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
KCAA Loma Linda, 1050 AM, 106.5 FM, and now 102.3 FM.
I'm Tim McGuire. President Trump tells a crowd at a political rally in Michigan that Washington Post journalist Bob Woodward's book